Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and of course Facebook has been in the news a lot lately for proliferating false news, swaying elections, or inadvertently contributing to swaying elections, and generally sowing discord. But that doesn't mean the mission statement of Facebook has actually changed. Here's Mark Zuckerberg at his testimony before Congress.
My top priority has always been our social mission of connecting people, building community, and bringing the world closer together.
Bringing the world closer together. Yes, in this incredibly divisive time, it's easy to be cynical about those sorts of statements. But my next guest tells the remarkable story of how Facebook allowed him to do just that. Mohammed al-Somali was raised in Yemen to hate Christians and Jews. But as he got older and started questioning things, the social media platform allowed him to meet some of those very people. And soon his so-called enemies were saving his life. Mohammed al-Somali is now an interfaith activist, and his book is called The Fox Hunt, a refugee's memoir of coming to America. Mohammed, so nice to have you on the show. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for hosting me.
So the book starts out in your early childhood, and right off the bat, we learn you were born into a pretty well-to-do family. Both parents were physicians. Your parents took two things very seriously, education and religion. Now, in America, when both parents are doctors, we might think it goes at odds a bit with a conservative religion. Was that ever the case?
It's not the case, because in general, the society in Yemen is kind of like religious. It's not an extreme religious, but we care about religion. We pray five times a day, and that was the environment where I was raised in Yemen. Most even of my friends were doing the same things. They pray five times a day. They fast Ramadan. We just like typical Muslims. But the environment where I was raised, it was kind of like questioning about the others, which means Christians or Jews. And the bigger question was, why Christians and Jews hate us?
So describe more of your upbringing in that respect, how you learned to hate Christians and Jews. How early in age did that idea get started at for you, or how did it get drilled into your head?
It's more about why Christians and Jews hate us, not about like why we hate them. We listen in the media, and this is before social media and before Facebook. When you open the TV, you only have a propaganda news. It tells you one side of the story. When you hear about what America did in Iraq, what America do in Afghanistan, you start feeling anger about what's happening, and you start questioning, like, why they hate us, and why there's this kind of hate against us. And I was raised like this. I was raised that, you know, Christians, Jews, they don't like benefits for us as Muslims. And this is not actually what Islam teaches us. Islam actually teaches us the opposite. It teaches us that we need to have dialogue with Christians, with Jews, and we need to have respect to each other. But the culture in general was the opposite. You see, when you live in a country that has a dictatorship system, the dictators, they don't want you to focus that you don't have democracy or you don't have education or you don't have hospitals, but they want you to focus on a fake enemy. And most of the time, the fake enemy is someone different than you. And in that case, it was Christians and Jews.
So you go to university and you meet an English professor named Luke, and I gather you agree to swap a Quran for a Bible. He has to read the Quran and you have to read the Bible. How'd that go?
Well, I mean, my intention was not reading the Bible at all. I went to him, and I wanted, you know, to let him know more about Islam. You know, he was a very kind person. He was very amazing. But one thing was missing in him is that he wasn't a Muslim. And I tried to convert him to Islam. So from my intention, I thought that, you know, if he would read the Quran, he would see how much it's an amazing book the Quran is. And I gave it to him. And surprisingly, you know, he told me, okay, I will read it in one condition. And he gave me a copy of the Bible. And this was a surprise for me. I started reading the Bible. But to be honest with you, when I started reading the Bible, I wasn't reading it just because I want to know more. I wanted to read the Bible to say, aha, my book is much better than this book. But what I found is the opposite. I found the similarities between Quran, the Torah, and the Bible. It's an amazing similarities. And I couldn't understand that, you know, why we have such hate speech if we have the same message.
Now, listeners, I wonder if anybody listening to Muhammad al-Samawi, author of Fox Hunt, a refugee's memoir of coming to America, and we'll get to his refugee story as we go, has had any experience in your life that's parallel to what we've heard so far of Muhammad's story, meaning were you raised to assume that others hate you and develop your own prejudices partly as a result of that, and have really meaningful exchange, like how he read the Bible and his professor, who was Christian, read the Quran. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. The civil war in Yemen is really heating up. As your book goes on, your family is Shia. So what does that mean in the context of your family's safety at the time, and how did it result in you coming to this country?
I need to tell you first, like in Yemen, there was nothing called Shia Sunnah. We were just Muslims. You know, I raised as a Muslim who went to the mosque, and there is no difference between if you are Shia or Sunnah. Unfortunately, the war, what's happening in Yemen, is a political war, and they're using a sectarian cover based on that. Unfortunately, it became a sectarian problem now in Yemen. Yes, my family background is Shia, but I never raised, you know, to speak about Sunnah or Shia. I raised just to be a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so sad for me, like, you know, what's happening right now in Yemen. It has been more than 3 years, and the war just killing a lot of people, killing a lot of children. You know, you wake up every day by a phone alarm. In Yemen, people wake up because an airstrike of Saudi Arabia.
Would you say that Yemen has become a battleground for a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
100%. I mean, this war, it has nothing about Yemenis themselves. It's a war between controlling between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And they're just, you know, playing on Yemeni souls. I lost two of my friends because of this war. I'm afraid not only about my family, I'm afraid about all the Yemenis. You have no idea how much requests I receive from people to ask me, can you please speak to the world about what's happening in Yemen? Can you imagine that if you live in a country that you can't even leave? There is no airport in Sana'a, in the capital city of Yemen. People can't actually come and tell you their own story. People tell me always that I have a great story, an amazing story, and I tell them, wait for the other Yemenis who unfortunately can't share their stories because of the war that's happening in Yemen right now.
Why is Yemen so desirable to big powers like Saudi Arabia and Iran? What do they want with Yemen?
I mean, the if you see the location of Yemen, it's a very strategic place. It's connecting Asia with Africa. There is a main port in Yemen called Aden, and most of the ships that want to go even to Egypt or Israel, it needs to go through this port. And that's why it's very important to control it. And not only that, Yemen is a very poor country, but it has something that makes Yemen very rich, which is human resources. We have 27 million people in Yemen. If you're controlling their ideology, if you're changing their behaviors to be in your side, you gain 27 million to be in your side. And that's what's happening now between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
How many Yemeni refugees are there at this point?
I will say a lot of millions. I don't have exact number about how many numbers, but I need to tell you the difference between the Syrian crisis and the Yemen crisis is that Syrians is able actually to leave in some way, either to Jordan or Lebanon or to Turkey. Yemenis, they don't have a place to leave. You know, like Saudi Arabia is controlling the whole country right now. Like nobody can leave either by sea or by flight. And that's why it's hard, you know, for people even to leave and to create a community outside of the war.
I've really been shocked recently how much the refugee question has fallen out of the news. Like even over the past few days, when the U.S., Britain, and France launched the missile strike on Syrian chemical weapon sites, we didn't hear anything about the refugees. I'm not sure those missile strikes themselves created any new refugees, but that's so much a part of the issue in Syria right now. just how many people are out there in limbo, and that the United States under President Trump is trying to drastically reduce the number of refugees who are allowed into this country. And we bomb Syria and the refugee question barely cracks any media other than this one with respect to implications. Do you have that feeling in general, and do you have that feeling for Yemen?
I mean, I can't understand how a military action can reduce the numbers of refugees. It always will actually improve the number of refugees. The only way, like why I became a refugee, and why a lot of people became a refugee, because they want to save their lives. They want to just, it's the only choice that they have. It's not a choice that I said, oh, you know what, I will move tomorrow from my capital city where my family lives, where I had a good life, and then, you know, I will go to another place to start from zero. And that's what happened to me. When I came to the United States, I had in my pocket $20. In Yemen, I am from a big family in Yemen. I used to have a good life. And then I came and started from the beginning. And people need to understand is that the war is not the answer. Airstrikes is not the answer. What we really need to do is that we need to have dialogue between the different parties, and need to be, if the Syrian problem, let it be between Syrians only. If it is about Yemen, let it be about Yemen only. Yemenis need to dialogue, and if you really want to help Yemenis, if you really want to help Syrians, try to create first a database that people can use so to understand what democracy is. People always speak about Bashar al-Assad, and Bashar al-Assad is an awful person, and he killed a lot of people in Syria. But who is the replacement? Because, you know, we don't learn, actually, in the Middle East, what democracy is, how I can really create someone who can be the leader of the future. And that's what, if really the United States want to help what's happening in Yemen and Syria, it needs to give the help and supply for the young leaders who can control the country in the future. It needs to help people by education, not by war.
My guest is Mohammed al-Samawi, author now of The Fox Hunt, a refugee's memoir of coming to America. He came from Yemen, where he was born in 1986 and obviously grew up. Since coming to the States, he's worked for several NGOs that promote peace and religious tolerance. And you've heard some of his own sort of coming to religious tolerance story as part of what we've been hearing so far. Our lines are full with people who want to share their own stories or talk to you. And let's go first to Kassar. Am I saying that right? In Queens?
That's correct, Brian. You got 90% of it right. Most of people don't. But anyway, you said it right, Brian.
Good. What's up?
Oh, you know, Brian, I listen to your show all the time. Thanks for getting me on. And I'm very, very impressed with the author of the or your guest, the way he is describing a situation. I'm just very curious, and I'll take his thoughts after I pose my question, and I'll get off the line. He mentioned something very curious, that in his adulthood he met an English professor with whom he swapped a Quran. And whom we swap a Bible, and at the age of adulthood, he realized that there were similarities between Bible and Quran. At the same time, he also mentioned that he was brought up in a very conservative Muslim household where the laws of Islam are pretty much followed. Now, I was brought up in the same scenario in Afghanistan, and I can tell you this, at the age of 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, I knew exactly what the value of Bible was in Islam, what the key tenets of Torah was followed in Islam. We were taught from childhood, right from the beginning, where the Bible stood in our beliefs, it was considered holy. Where the Torah stood in our beliefs, it was considered holy. So find his claim, him being brought up in a conservative value, not knowing and understanding what Bible represented to Muslims. To us, Bible is represented as equal or similar to Quran. We already knew from the age of 5, 6, and 7, and 8 and up, where all these holy books stood.
And that, Kassar, the end piece of that for you as a young Muslim was to learn that, the Jews through the Torah started something important, the Christians through the Bible and the Jesus story and everything continued to build on it, and then it was sort of perfected through Islam?
Well, no. You see, this is where the issue comes in. It is not you know, the moment we get into mine is better than yours, that's where the problem comes.
Right.
That's where the difference between an enlightened Muslim versus a Muslim who just follows a line and later on says, well, my line is bigger than yours.
Right. And that goes for all religions. Qasar, I'm going to leave it there for time and just ask Muhammad what he's thinking. Muhammad, as you heard his call.
No, I totally agree with him. I mean, that's also what I learned in school, that, you know, Bible is a holy book. But we also learned in school that because the Bible has been kind of converted by rabbis, by popes, you know, they changed some of the Bible. And that's why the Quran came. And that's why we have a new book. If the Bible is a holy book, and as we believe in Islam, then the Quran came to complete it. But on the other hand, we do believe that also some phrases of the Bible have been changed, and it's not 100% like, you know, as God gave it to us. And that's why when I was reading it, I wanted to find the difference, not the similarities. But I ended by reading the similarities more than the difference.
Yeah, and the title of your book, The Fox Hunt, refers to a story from the Talmud, right?
Correct, yes. It's the story about how, you know, when I use social media and I ask people to help me out in social media, I asked everyone that I know. And the amazing thing that, you know, the people who really respond, three of them are Jews and one of them is Christian. And, of course, some Muslims also helped me out. But when these people, like, they responded to my request and they said, we want to help you out. It reminds me of the story of the Talmud when a group of fish was trying to escape from a fishman. And they saw a fox, and the fox told them, hey, come with me. I can hide you from the fishermen. But they never trusted the fox because the fox can eat them. And they left away. And a rabbi said that maybe this is the right thing to do. And my story is telling the difference. What if I actually ignored Daniel, Megan, Natasha, and Justin when they asked me for help? Maybe I will not be here with you today.
We'll continue in a minute with Muhammad Al-Samawi and your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Muhammad Al-Samawi, author of The Fox Hunt, a refugee's memoir of coming to America, and Sasha in Jersey City. You're on WNYC. Hello, Sasha.
Thanks for having this guest on, and I'm a longtime supporter of the show. I have a different experience than what I'm hearing a little bit, and that is, the following. I grew up with a family who's from South Asia, Muslims, and this was 20, 25 years ago, and we have to admit that Islam many decades ago was certainly more affected by secularism, and that's kind of, there is this upsurge in conservative application of Islam, but growing up with a family, close friends of ours who used to have Quranic classes in their house, and I grew up in their house and used to sit with them and learn, it was interesting to see the opposite. What happened with them is that as the religion began to become more conservative over the decades, they strayed away from it. They became more secular, ultimately being atheists, and that was at great expense.
Sasha, I'm gonna leave it there for time, but the story that he's telling, Muhammad, is in a way the story of the world right now. There are all these pulls in so many religions and countries and cultures toward some kind of group nationalism, if you want to call it that, kind of in response to the growing secularism and globalism in the world. So whether it's, strong strains of orthodox thought within Judaism or conservative thought within Islam or Trump's America First nationalism in response to what people were not happy about in the developing modern world in the 20th century. All those tugs seem to be taking a lot of nations and a lot of religions, or at least certain percentage of people from each, in a more conservative direction. Do you Would you agree with that characterization, and do you feel like you're fighting against that tide? Mohammed?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, first of all, I'm speaking about my own experience in Yemen, and definitely, you know, in different cultures and different countries, there will be a different experience. In any way, I just spoke about my own experience in Yemen.
Well, toward the end of the book, as you're thinking about getting a visa to the U.S., you write, "If I could tell Americans about what was happening in Yemen, maybe I could help stop the war." So I wonder how much of the book is trying to inform the American public about what's happening in Yemen through your own remarkable and hopefully marketable narrative. People love stories about bridging divides, and people tend to ignore wars when they go on as long as this one. So how much are you trying to inform the American public, hoping that it'll bring more attention to what's happening in Yemen?
One reason that I decided to write this book is that I have a guilt of surviving. I feel that, you know, I'm speaking right now with you and I'm drinking water. I don't know even what my family doing or what other Yemenis do. The pictures that I see every day from Yemen, it's just dark and darkness. And that's why I decided to write the book. I decided to write in the book, it's a memoir, but also I want to educate people about what's happening in Yemen. And that's why even the cover of the book, I put, like, you know, the picture of old Sana'a, because I want people to understand how Yemen is beautiful and how the war is making it ugly.
Jennifer in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know we're running short on time, but I just wanted to let your guests know that some 20 years ago, I actually traveled to Yemen as part of a Drew University International Seminar. I believe that we were the first undergraduate group ever to travel to the country, and I agree, it is so beautiful. The people are so warm. It's heartbreaking. And so I think about the Yemenis all these years later. I traveled to many of the cities that you're talking about, and I want to know, what do you think a group like ours, you know, who 20 years later still wants to be involved, what can we sort of do today for other refugees here in this country, or continuing education efforts? What do you think are some of the best things we can do here on the ground in this country today?
Thank you. Mohammed?
Thank you so much for this question. One of the reasons why the war still continues in Yemen is that actually, unfortunately, the United States is one of the countries who's supporting the war in Yemen. You know, United States selling weapons to Saudi Arabia by billions of dollars. These bombs, these airstrikes, is actually made in United States. And that's why people are struggling today. People in Yemen looking to United States as the leader of the world, who can really bring justice to Yemenis, who can really stop the war in Yemen. And one way to do it is call your senator. As a citizen of the United States, you have the right to call your senator and tell him that I'm not happy how the United States is supporting the war in Yemen, and we need to end this. And this is need to happen today before, you know, people more suffering in Yemen. That's one way. The other way that you can be involved, there's an organization here in the United States called Yemen Peace Project. And Yemen Peace Project, the founder who founded this, his name, Will Bickard, he used to live in Yemen. And he loves Yemen, he is attached to Yemen, and he really wants to help Yemen. If you want to volunteer with them, just go to their website, yemenpeaceproject.org, and be part of the organization. Donate if you want to donate, because it's the only organization right now kind of doing lobbying for congressmen, for senators, to inform them about how the United States is playing a role in this war.
What would you like to see the United States do differently, specifically?
Just hosting a dialogue between different parties in Yemen. That would be great. And if United States, just believe me, if United States cut the support for Saudi Arabia, this war will end soon.
So the United States could play a role in ending the war, you're saying?
100%. And as I told you, like, you know, one of the reasons why this war is continuing is that Saudi Arabia feels that there is acceptance from United States for this war to continue. And United States, like the government in the United States, need to understand something, is that this war is affecting Yemenis, but the more that affected is kids and children in Yemen. There is no schools, there is no universities. People who need to work, they don't work. Even my own parents, there's no hospitals. How are they going to live? Do you know how they're going to live? The only way to live and to have money or food, either to be part of Al-Qaeda or to be part of Houthis, which means that you will be part of extreme groups that eventually their message is hate against the United States.
Mohammed Al-Samawi, interfaith activist and author now of The Fox Hunt, a refugee's memoir of coming to America. Now, if you want to see him in person, next Tuesday, April 24th, he'll be in conversation with Daniel Pincus, one of the four Americans who helped him escape, in conversation as well with the Forward's executive director, Dan Friedman. Now, that's a ticketed event. You'll have to pay to get in, but that is at Uten and Golden LLP, 685 3rd Avenue, 25th floor. That's 6:30 next Tuesday, April 24th, for Mohammed Al-Samawi. Thank you so much for coming on with us. Good luck to you and your family.
Thank you. Thank you so much.